The Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Hello, and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about furry logic, the physics of animal life, which is a new book by Liz Callagher and Mateen Jurani. And I'm delighted to say that I am joined in the shed by Liz Callagher and Mateen Jurani.
Hello.
Hi.
Brilliant to be here.
Thanks very much. Just the ideal people to speak to about a book that you've written.
That we've written, yeah.
This podcast is about the way that science and storytelling collide. And storytelling has many different guises. This is the first time we've talked about a popular science book. I'm interested in how you go about telling stories in a popular science book. But before we get to that, animals and physics. Do squirrels work at the Large Hadron Collider?
They do. There's a whole army of them underground. It's a 27-kilometre collider, so there must be a fair few down there.
Yeah.
Don't know what nationality they've got.
French and Swiss.
Swiss.
Yeah, teaming up.
Right, OK, so joking apart, in what way do animals use physics?
All sorts of ways. We've got chapters in the book on every type of physics going. Forces, fluids, electricity and magnetism, heat, light and the other one.
Sound.
Yeah. Yep, sound. And in each chapter we've got four or five animals that use those types of physics in different ways. So we've got turtles that use magnetic fields to navigate, squirrels that confuse snakes by heating up their tails to upset the snake's infrared detection system.
Ooh, we've got mosquitoes that survive collisions with raindrops, and we've got dogs, all about why they shake themselves dry, which is to save energy, because if they let themselves evaporate off, they get very, very cold and dead, probably. Well, it all started a couple of years ago when I work as editor of Physics World magazine, and Liz reviewed a book for us that she said she didn't really like, but was trying to be complimentary about. She came into my desk and I said, you know, I bet we could do a better job. And then she said, well, what sort of book could we write about? And I said, animals and physics. We published a special issue of Physics World about that topic. And there'd been so many examples of animals that use physics that we thought, aha, Bloomsbury, the publishers, thought what a great idea and commissioned us.
And this is the first book you've both written?
Yep, it's the first book either of us has written and the first book we've written together.
So. Yeah. I'm interested in that writing together thing as well. How does that work? Do you do a word each?
We sort of did.
Yeah, it's like consequences.
I wrote all the words starting with A to M. And we basically divided up the animals, so we did about 15 each. Liz reckons she did one more, but I dispute that. I think we did about the same. And so we sort of divided them up by different animals and we looked into them, and then we each wrote about the animals and then we mashed it all up.
We each took kind of control of one chapter and put the physics between the animals and wove it all together.
So when you're writing the book, is there anything that kind of shocked you about the way animals use physics?
I think the thing I found most surprising was for animals that sense things that we can't, so like ultraviolet or electric fields or magnetic fields, that actually makes it really hard for the researchers to picture and get inside their heads what they're actually seeing. And that's where the physics kit comes in for them to use that, to see that animal's world.
Because there's one example of the peacock. And if anyone's heard a peacock, it makes a really raucous noise. Horrible. But the researchers discovered by taping peacocks at a zoo and recording their sounds that they also emit sounds we can't hear. They're so low in frequency. They're below our audible threshold of 20 hertz, I think they're at. And that's called infrasound. But they use that infrasound to woo peahens.
What, like a deep voice?
Actually, we should have used that example. Very, very sort of... Who's that guy? That big soul singer?
Oh, yeah, Barry White.
Barry Fry-esque.
Barry White.
Barry, he's a footballer. Barry White. Barry Fry's got a very high-pitched
voice. Are you a Birmingham City?
I am, actually.
Oh, OK, that's where that came from, yeah.
Barry White.
That was nice when we were writing the book. I get a Birmingham City score update every weekend.
Ah, okay.
It was very helpful.
Yeah, that put a spanner in the works. Every time we lost, I was in a grumpy mood and didn't write very much, but our performance picked up, so okay. So did my writing.
Yeah. And so is that... I've never written a book. Sometimes I'm tempted because I'm alive. That's what people do. They get tempted to write a book. But you guys have actually done it. You know, do you feel like you know everything in the book now?
Well, I suppose because we're professional writers, both of us, we write so much that you kind of lose your... you don't become too precious about it. And in fact, Liz and I went out to celebrate the release of the book last week. We went for a pizza. She finished way after me, so I was wolf mine down. So I was reading bits of words from the index. Liz couldn't remember half of the things or the people, and I couldn't remember, did I write that? Yeah. But one interesting point is that I think for when a lot of scientists write about their science, they're so attached to it that they can't divorce themselves from the science, and they have to cram in everything they've ever done. And I think as journalists, we tell stories all the time. So we just put in whatever we think is interesting to make a good story. And that's where journalists can be better science storytellers than scientists themselves. Mm. Because we're more dispassionate, disinterested. Mm. Not uninterested, disinterested.
Yes, yeah. Physics World, correct me if I'm wrong, but Physics World is written for physicists.
That's right.
More than the general public. But this book is more for the general public. Yeah.
And for anyone, we think, probably from teenage upwards.
Did you find that a challenge writing for a different audience?
I think because we're both not highly qualified in biology, I think that made it easier. And because huge numbers of people are interested in animals, you've got both the story about the animal's life and the life of the researcher and how they're investigating it. So I think that helps make it accessible.
I open the book and the first thing I see is... you start writing about Indiana Jones and snakes. Is that a deliberate choice? Obviously, that piques my interest because it's science fiction, it's storytelling, it's what this podcast's about, and it's science. But is that the kind of thing that you're doing?
Like all stories, you have to have a good hook at the beginning. And in that case, we used a scene in Indiana Jones, and you look for a hook to draw the reader in that's quite intriguing, or there's a good anecdote, or fact, or quote.
That's a really striking image in that Indiana Jones scene, that big pit of snakes. And in fact, because that's what the red-sided garter snakes do, one of my friends, I showed her the book last week and she can't actually read that chapter.
Really?
Yes, she doesn't like snakes.
Yeah, so. I think that's fair. But I learned something immediately in the first paragraph, which is that the snakes, not all the snakes in that scene are snakes, and some of them are bits of hose.
They didn't have enough of the snakes that they wanted because they had to get some legless lizards, which aren't snakes.
Yeah.
And some cut-up hoses.
Yeah, presumably legless lizards are legless lizards rather than snakes.
But... yes, but they look like snakes.
Okay, so what is the difference then?
To a biologist, it's absolutely crucial. But to a film producer?
No, it doesn't really matter. Or indeed a film audience, I imagine.
Yeah.
Most of us, anyway. But so tell me about red garter snake.
Well, we kind of got... started the book with this story because it's just so strange that they're a type of snake. They're the most northerly living reptile in the Western Hemisphere. How's that for a fact? So they live out in Canada in the plains of Manitoba, where it basically is very, very cold all winter, 9 months a year. So what the snakes do is they hide underground in these giant burrows, thousands strong, and they hibernate there. It's actually called brumation. They brumate because they're reptiles. And they do that. And then in the spring, when it warms up, they come out. They're so cold and lethargic, they come out and the males exist in these giant mating balls, hundreds or thousands strong, huge heaps of snakes. And they're there, and people always wondered what on earth is going on, why are they writhing around in these giant balls. They're so cold and lethargic, you can literally pick up the snake by its tail and they don't run away. Normally, if you're a biologist, you try and find a snake. They either bite you or slither off. Yeah. But these are so cold, you can pick them up. So what Rick Shine, who's an Australian snake biologist, he went up to these snake pits for I think 7 years out of eight, about a decade ago, and he did a heap of experiments about these snakes. And what he found was, first of all the snakes in this writhing mass are males. The females just leg it, because they're scared. Because the males want to have sex, basically. And these female snakes, if the males jump on them, it's horrible, so they disappear. So the males are all writhing around in this big ball. But then he discovered some of the males pretend to be females. They cover themselves in pheromones, chemicals that make other snakes think they're females.
Right.
So that was the real mystery. Why do these males pretend to be females?
Yeah.
And the answer is that he did various experiments by warming the snakes up on the front seat of his car because he could.
Yeah.
And he discovered that the reason they do that is that if they pretend to be females, the other males jump on them and warm them up.
Mm.
So it's all a case of them warming up as fast as possible. Because out in Canada, you do not want to be a cold snake because you might get eaten by a bird or a crow.
Because you can't move fast if you're cold.
So it's an absolutely mysterious story of sort of physics and sex and gender swapping. I'm allowed to say sex on the Cosmic Show.
You are allowed to say sex on the Cosmic Show. When you're talking about terrifying snakes trying to have sex with women, and all I'm thinking about is Donald Trump. But yes, so the physics of that is that they can move quicker when they're hotter, is that right?
They kind of snuggle up to the other, to the male snakes, these she-male snakes, basically to steal heat from them. It's called kleptothermy, is the biological name. And so they're basically just using conduction.
So the challenge there was telling a story of all that complicated thing, getting it in the right order, and that was one story we really struggled with. But because we weren't doing the work, we could just tell it in any way they like. And I'm sure if a biologist told it, they'd want to do it right from the start, in the right order, and how dare you mess the story up. Mm. But we created a story, we put a story on it that made sense, we hope.
Jim Al-Khalili, who's a former guest on the Cosmic Shed, has reviewed your book. He says... it is packed with insight and information. That's pretty good, isn't it? Mm. There's loads of good reviews here. Wonderful, wild and witty, says The Guardian. Right. Illuminating, intriguing, entertaining, fresh insight from Dame Athene Donald, Professor of Experimental Physics at the University of Cambridge. That's pretty good.
We like them.
They're our friends.
I was actually going to say, I got kind of sidetracked by that, is that Jim Al-Khalili was on our Jurassic Park episode. And there are dinosaurs in this book.
Yes, well, they're winged reptiles.
Okay, pterosaurs.
What are they called? Yes, they're not technically dinosaurs, which is disappointing.
It is disappointing, isn't it? They do appear in the worst Jurassic Park film. Taken as read that Jurassic Park 3 is the worst one.
I've only seen Jurassic Park, so I'm afraid I'm not qualified to comment.
Routine?
Don't ask me about films.
Okay.
I live under a cultural stone when it comes to films.
Oh, do you?
I've never seen Star Wars.
This podcast is over.
I tried once, but I just got bored. And there's too much sort of backstory that I just can't be bothered anymore. You know?
That's astonishing. I'm going to try and get past that and ask the next question.
It's a different show. I haven't seen Star Wars.
Yeah,
there is.
Yeah. Wow.
I feel under such pressure to enjoy it now. Like, how could I not like it? And there's all 35 years of cultural baggage associated. And I haven't got time for it.
That'd be easy enough.
Is that my homework?
Yeah. Okay. Watch the new one and come back. So pterosaurs. Tell me about pterosaurs. They've got funny bones or something.
Yeah. Turns out that paleontologists quite like to argue about things, particularly dinosaur or ancient reptile skeletons. And one particular thing they're arguing about is this pteroid bone in the pterosaur. So these were huge pterodactyls or pterosaurs, and some of them were small, some of them were the size of a London bus, that kind of wingspan. So they're at the limits of being able to take off because they're pretty heavy. And these guys are arguing about the way that their wrist bone joined on, and one Matt Wilkinson, who was at Cambridge University, tried to solve that argument by making a model of a pterosaur wing and putting it in a wind tunnel, and he reckoned that the bone pointed forward, which meant the pterosaur could kind of furl its forewing up and down, which so it could bend it into the wind, and that would help it take off. So that would mean it wouldn't have to live by the seaside, because they think a lot of them just used to jump off cliffs into the wind rather than flapping, because their wings are almost too big to flap and take off, so they would soar.
Like?
Albatross.
Albatross.
I guess the reason they were arguing about these fossils is there's only very few of them that were found in sort of 3D form from some pits in Brazil, whereas normally as it's fossilised, the skeleton kind of gets jumbled up, and the bones that were next to each other in the live animal might not be anymore, because the ligaments and tendons might have pulled them apart.
But of course they don't really know physics. This is the theme I come to at the end of the book. We both come to at the end of the book. Do animals consciously know physics? It's not something we go into very much, but that's a question that can apply to even humans. How much physics do we know? We use physics when it's needed. So, you know, if someone attacks you with a sharp knife, your knowledge of metals will be that a sharp metal blade will be dangerous and we'll duck and we calculate how fast to move and that kind of thing. So we kind of intuitively know physics principles.
Mm.
But whether you understand the mechanics or the physics or the equations behind that is debatable.
Yeah, there are these things, as you were talking about earlier, Liz, that beyond what we can do, they use senses, in a sense, or stretch their senses further than we can stretch ours, and experience things that we can't, like turtles and the sensing the magnetism of the Earth. What? How? What?
Yeah, they don't quite know how yet. In earlier studies, they did find bits of magnetite inside turtles, which is a bit of iron ore, which you can use in a compass needle. And they think if that aligns itself, so moves inside an animal, it could press on nerves, and then that would give it an indication of which way it's facing. Ken Lohman in the States puts some turtles in an MRI scanner from his local hospital, and they couldn't find any magnetite. But that could be because it's too small.
Okay.
Or they could be doing it in a quantum way, using cryptochromes in the back of their retinas.
Okay. So we don't really know how, but do we know why?
We do know, well, we know why in a sense. The particular turtles he looked at are loggerheads. And when they hatch, these ones, there's a huge nesting ground in eastern Florida. The turtle hatchlings are about 2 inches long and they're very vulnerable. There are birds trying to eat them. So they use their tiny flippers to scrape down the beach to the ocean where the fish start trying to eat them as well. So being attacked from both sides. So pretty much the only thing they can do is head out to sea where there are fewer predators, and they actually head out to the Atlantic where they drift round for about 5 or 10 years until they're about 2 foot long, and then the only thing that can eat them is sharks.
Right.
So they're a lot safer. So then they come home to the feeding grounds off Nicaragua and kind of Central America, and then they hang out there eating for about 10 years. Nice life.
Wow, this is amazing. Yeah.
And then when they're ready to mate, when they're about 20 years old, they head north again, back to the beach where they were born. So their whole trip around the Atlantic, they need to keep themselves on track so they don't end up in the Arctic or too far south and get lost.
Yeah.
And they do that magnetically.
How do we know that they're using the magnetism of that stuff to do that?
It was Ken Lohman who discovered, and he actually built a huge circular swimming pool, basically, with electric current, with wires around it, so he could put electric currents through and create a magnetic field, so he could mimic the magnetic fields of anywhere in Earth, on Earth, just by changing the current. And he found he put turtle hatchlings in little fluorescent tabards, which he tethered them, and then changed the magnetic field, and they would change direction.
Wow.
So what he thinks is once they get to kind of Spain and Portugal, the magnetic fields there tell them to head south, then they head down to North Africa, where the fields tell them to head west. And that's inbuilt in these hatchlings, they know that.
That's amazing.
Just to change.
I assume it's not just turtles that are using this kind of system. Do you know of any other animals that are using it?
European robins and pigeons also. They don't migrate around the Atlantic, obviously, but they navigate magnetically, I believe. And there was a guy at Manchester University in the 80s who blindfolded his students.
Is that allowed?
I think he got permission.
Manchester.
Yeah, that's okay.
drove them out into the local hills and asked them to point to the campus. And they did it surprisingly well until he held a bar magnet to their temples.
What?
Yes.
So that's sounds a bit dodgy.
I'm not convinced by this.
No.
Controversial. People tried to replicate it, and there was arguments back and forth for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And then people gave up. But Ken Lohman thinks it's possible that we can do that, but that our environment is so magnetically kind of disrupted because we've got steel buildings, we've got electricity, we've got electric fields and so magnetic fields everywhere, that maybe our magnetic powers have been disrupted.
Okay. I'm not going to pass judgment on that one. I'm dubious, let's say that. Right, I think this book is incredibly full of things like this. I don't want to give away too much more, but I just want to say, I was joking, obviously, when I said the squirrels do physics, but if there's one living creature on this earth that I think might be clever enough to do it, it'd be the octopus.
Mm.
There are these particular octopus
called
Japetella heathi, which I've only seen written down, but yeah. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
And Sonka Johnson in America discovered if you're in the ocean at depths, it's very, very dark.
Because the light doesn't get hardly anywhere near below the surface. It's dark, it's black. Mm.
Yeah.
I've got a 4-year-old, so I know this because I watch The Octonauts all the time.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Which everyone should do, even if you've not got children. It's brilliant. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
I don't have children. I've seen The Octonauts. Yes. I very much enjoyed it.
It's great, isn't it? Midnight Zone, Under the Water. Anyway, and The Twilight Zone. Fantastic stuff. Sorry, back to the octopus.
That's quite all right. So when you're higher up, you're better off to be transparent because predators can't see your shadow if they're looking up at you from down below. But actually, if you're transparent in the dark zone, a surprising amount of light reflects back from you. It's like shining a torch at a window at night. You'll see a glint coming back. But during the day, that is not enough to notice the pane of glass that's there. Because of refraction, because the tissues in the octopus's body are all slightly different densities, the light bounces back each time it gets to a different type of tissue. So what it actually does is it changes colour as it gets down to the depths, where there are fish that have fluorescent torch beams above their eyes that are blue on the whole. So they're looking out for octopus, and these octopus turn themselves red because then the blue beams will be absorbed.
God, it's clever, isn't it?
I mean, it's just mind-boggling, isn't it, that there's creatures underneath the sea who are changing colour because of that.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Love it. Right, if you like that, and you should, buy Furry Logic. And we'll post a link to how you can buy it, obviously, on the website. But writing a book, there's probably people listening to the podcast who are thinking, I want to do it. Any top tips?
Do it, it's fun.
I think you need to pick a topic that you're interested in, is one thing. And you also need to pick a topic that hasn't been done a million times before, and I think with this book it wasn't something that I'd ever seen before, because you get so many books about quantum physics or astronomy, that kind of thing, and this was something I'd never seen before, where you take different branches of physics and describe them through the guise of animals. That made it easy because you weren't constantly worrying about some other book that had done that same thing 100 times before or better.
And I think another thing is find some people who really, really enjoy their work to talk to, because every single researcher we spoke to was very interesting to talk to and very enthusiastic about their work.
It's funny, I don't want to generalise, but I will. But, you know, most of our, Liz and my work, we talk to physical scientists, physicists, and I found actually talking to the biologists and zoologists, they were certainly different. They were more happy just to talk about their work and simplify it and be quite honest about what they did. I think physicists can be a little bit... try and make it all sound very, very complicated. Well, it is very... Well, there's a debate. Is physics harder than biology? We had to talk about this at the start of the book. Some people say Liz thinks biology is harder because you've got so many variables and things you can change in the environment. Physicists can sit in a lab, put a bit of semiconductor on a microscope and turn a knob and get some results, whereas animals move and do stuff. There's all sorts of other things.
I completely think that's... Yeah, physics is definitely the science that makes most sense to me. It's sort of, you know, it follows logic more than... I mean, there's no logic in octopuses changing colour. It doesn't make any sense.
And they also live right at the bottom of the ocean, so they're quite hard to access.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mind you, so are distant galaxies. So
that's true.
But it's coming back to that thing about animals having sort of superpowers that we might think are superpowers. The other one example in the book is the fact that bees can detect electric field from flowers. Because I didn't even know flowers have electric fields, but they have an electric field from thunderstorms. That's weird. But bees can detect them.
And Lyra, my daughter, the other day we were sitting in a cafe, and there was a bee buzzing around her bike helmet, which is red and spotty. And I said to her, I think it thinks it's a flower. And she said, Daddy, why do bees know how to go to flowers? And I thought, I don't know, actually. I'll look it up. I didn't need to look it up because I read it in your book. And everybody should do that. Anyway, Liz and Mateen, thank you very much indeed for joining me in the Cosmic Shed.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And
thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening. Goodbye. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.